Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Professor Joan Williams, has spent many years researching social inequality, class, race, and gender, so she understands why Democrats lose and Republicans win. The title of her new book says it all, Outclassed: How the Left Lost the Working Class and How to Win Them Back. She says if liberals and the left want to win, they must change class dynamics driving U.S. politics. Joan Williams is an award-winning scholar of social inequality. She's professor of law and Hastings Foundation Chair Emerita at the University of California College of the Law, San Francisco. Professor Williams is the author of many books, including White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America, and has published on class dynamics in the New York Times, the New Republic, and many other publications. Her latest book is Outclassed. If you're in the Bay Area, Joan Williams will be speaking Tuesday, May 27th at 5:30 p.m. at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, and on Wednesday, May 28th at 7 p.m. at Mrs. Dalloway's bookstore in Berkeley. Hi, Joan. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, it's great to have you. So much of what you describe in your book, and one of the main reasons why Democrats are losing and Republicans are winning, is because of neoliberalism.
Indeed, indeed. Neoliberalism, number one, increased radically the inequality between people, and it also radically increased inequality between regions. So we have like winner take all cities like San Francisco, but then a lot of the other areas in the country got left behind. And the idea was that we should concentrate economic growth on the creative cities and just let to die the areas in Kansas where people are very, very rooted and very, very place loyal. And people couldn't put together a stable middle-class life. They couldn't find jobs for their children. So their children left in a context where in these kind of routine white-collar and blue-collar and pink-collar families, the expectation is that children would stay and be part of their parents' networks for their entire lives. It's very different from life in kind of the professional managerial elite. And these areas got really, really angry. Trump won two-thirds of the areas in the counties where non-college grads predominate in 2016. And the rural areas have become very, very red. All you have to do is look at a electoral map of the country, and there's that great ocean of red in the middle of the country.
I mean, the statistics you cite in the chapter, Why Are Rural and Rust Belts Red? These just need to be repeated over and over again. And we really need to have a discussion about how we got here and what's next. We can cite statistics for the entire hour, but the numbers are really head spinning. I mean, even when you look at the fact that Obama, even though, as you write, he bailed out Wall Street, I forgot because there's so much going on. I forgot that so many mega mergers happened under Obama's Justice Department, and we'll talk about those. But in 10 largely Midwestern states, Democrats lost 1.2 million more votes among factory towns than they gained in metropolitan, college, and suburban counties. Rural counties more reliant on manufacturing 20 years ago shifted hardest to the right between 2012 and 2020. I mean, these numbers are really incredible, Joan, and I just wonder, well, this is part of your book, you know, why the Democrats don't talk more about this.
Yeah, I mean, Obama got about 40% of rural votes, which we kind of forget. It wasn't that long ago. Biden got only about 20%. And this sharp fall in support from rural areas has a lot of very negative consequences on American politics. First of all, it's really hard to lose the Senate with that, I mean, to win the Senate with that ocean of red in the middle of the country. And of course, with the Electoral College has a built-in bias in favor of states with small populations. So this is, we just can't leave the entire middle of the country behind and expect to be able to enact any kind of progressive policies. On the other hand, if we can't expect to win the rural vote if we keep making fun of people and saying, what's the matter with Kansas? They don't understand their own self-interest. Instead of actually listening to people and understanding why they are so disillusioned and ticked off with Democrats, and that they don't think anybody's going to help them. And at least Republicans connect on them in terms of cultural values.
And we'll talk about that in a minute, but because you brought up the Electoral College, I'm wondering how you think about the aspects of the system that are so undemocratic. The Electoral College, for example, gerrymandering. I mean, to think that five Supreme Court justices were appointed by a president who lost the popular vote, and this is head spinning to people living in other countries. So, given the work that you do on race, class, and gender, how do you think about the undemocratic aspects of our system and how so many of those aspects got us to this point?
Well, I think that that progressives have to take responsibility for the fact is the system is what it is. We ain't going to change the Electoral College. That ain't going to happen. Now, one thing that could happen is that we could just award states votes proportionally. That we could do, my understanding is, without changing the Constitution. But the fact is that about two-thirds of white non-college voters voted for Trump and always do. And even more shocking, Democrats lost like 30 points among non-college people of color. And among non-college people of color who are young, we lost over 40 points in the last election. Younger voters shifted away from Democrats by almost 20 points. So this something is going on, and we can't wait for these, meta solutions like abolishing the Electoral College to turn things around,
What
especially
about,
now that we're on a short road to fascism.
well, exactly. Well, that was the other question I was going to ask you. So, when you say that we can't leave these people behind or talk down to them, I think part of the problem now is that so many people are voting for a man who is so openly racist and is a fascist. I mean, a number of fascist historians say that he is a fascist. We've got the sexual assault charges, family separation. And so people are saying, well, millions of people are voting for this man. How do we talk to them? How do you think about that question?
Well, first of all, look how he talked to them. Democrats ran their campaign on defense of democracy and abortion rights. Trump ran his campaign on inflation, the economy, and immigration. Now, we're not going to sell out immigrants. We can talk about that later. But inflation and the economy were were top of mind for many voters, and overwhelmingly top of mind for voters without college degrees. Defense of democracy, as passionately as I feel about it and you feel about it, if you think that democracy has kind of screwed you and let you down for the last 40 years, which objectively it has, by the way, you may not be, defense of democracy is not going to be high up on your list of priorities. And in fact, defense of democracy was way, way high up for Democrats, but it was way, way down for people who voted for Trump. They were focused on inflation and the economy. Now, as usual, Trump lied that he was going to help on inflation and the economy, and he's doing this time even more than he did last time to make things worse for working class people. Basically, the only things that many working class people, and by I'm using the term working class, but what the research shows, it's it, the people who veer far right are routine people in routine jobs, so pink collar, blue collar, and routine white collar, what are called middle status voters. They are the people who are veering far right across Europe and the United States. And the thing that really matters to them is they want an economy where hard work will lead to a stable middle class life. That's what they want. They are climate change, really important to me, and I suspect to you, is 14th in terms of priorities for non-college voter, said one survey. They are more focused on the end of the month rather than the end of the world. So when we do things like call them climate deniers, you know, I hear that and I know the science, but that is heard as college grads in a snooty way insulting the intelligence of non-college grads.
How do you deal with the racist aspects of all of this?
Well, you know, racism is pretty important. It is the race is one of the strongest predictors. Racism is one of the strongest predictors of votes for Trump. There's no way around that. So if you're a racist, you are going to vote for Trump. But what is less well known is that that's not enough votes for him to win. Trump wins because he also picks up large quantities of voters whose racial attitudes don't differ very much from non-Trump voters. One study called these the anti-elites. And what progressives and Democrats have to do is to understand this group of anti-elites and understand how to connect with them. And by the way, it's pretty hard to argue that Trump is all about racism when you have these large shifts of non-college voters towards Trump in the last election.
Because he attracted an increased percentage of people of color this time around.
Yeah, still fewer of people of color than proportionally than whites, but a big, you know, 30, 40% increase.
Can you elaborate on what you're calling anti-elites?
The stable middle class in the United States is very focused on self-discipline. The kind that kind of gets you up every day and to a not very fulfilling job. My crowd, you know, I'm a law professor. We're focused on self-development. If you think about the issues that are prioritized among the middle class, it's issues that will allow you to ensure that hard work will pay off in a stable middle class standard of living. If wages had continued to rise when productivity did, like it did after World War II, wages would be 43% higher than they are now. That's the issue that is really front and center to these routine white-collar voters. And I was just, you know, I'm on book tour and I was just around Washington, D.C., and you wouldn't believe how many professionals have lost their jobs. And you know what they're thinking about now? They're thinking about stable jobs. So it's quite understandable where with people who are in rural areas or in neighborhoods with non-college grads who, you know, they're patching together five jobs with no childcare and no and they can't no health insurance. That's what they're focused on. And we have to understand that, college grads, we often take self-discipline and stability for granted. But for these folks, it's very cherished and often very hard-earned. And so if you think back to that famous ad of, Kamala cares about they, them, Trump cares about you, it's totally true that that ad appealed to transphobic people. Clearly it did. But it also appealed to people who thought, my economic future sucks. Why aren't Democrats talking about that?
Right. Can you please repeat that 43% statistic again?
If after World War II, wages used to rise when productivity did, that stopped abruptly, to use the, I mean, because of neoliberalism, writ large. If wages had continued to rise when productivity did, they would be 43% higher than they
Incredible.
are now. And so this is often talked about as the need for more blue collar or manufacturing jobs. And it's true, we've lost a lot of manufacturing jobs, and that's really important for this middle status group. But that's not all that's going on. Wages are just too low. And I was on a conservative radio program this morning, and I was like, he was going, yeah, wages are too low. How hard was that?
What else did you talk about on that show?
My life is a blur. I've had one or two interviews since then, but
Okay.
I was on the last book tour I was on, with the White Working Class book, I was actually on Fox News. And I said, wages are too low, working people have gotten screwed. And they said, like what she said. There was one study of Tucker Carlson, no less, of a 5-year period, and he channeled anger against elites, including economic elites, in 70% of the shows. Rupert Murdoch is smart enough to know that if he wants to sell papers and get people to listen to his media and win elections, he's got to allow people to express the real economic anger that's out there, including against economic elites. But Democratic donors need to understand that they need to allow this anti-elitist rhetoric as well. Republican donors long since smartened up.
That was really interesting to learn about. You write, most progressives only know Fox from dismissive sound bites on MSNBC or the mocking references on their favorite comedy show. But if you go back and watch Tucker Carlson, you'll see his critique of neoliberal economics. In a 2018 episode called There Is Nothing Free About This Market, Tucker Carlson slammed Walmart and Uber for exploiting their workers and praised Bernie Sanders for pressuring Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos to raise wages. Media scholar Reese Peck told you, Carlson consistently copies Trump's greatest rhetorical trick, which is to co-opt left populist critiques against war, wealth concentration, and corporate power to build support for the far right. This is attractive to both Fox's older viewers and younger voters who are former Democrats. This is interesting, too. In 2021, Tucker Carlson gained more Democratic viewers in the 25 to 54 age demographic than MSNBC and CNN, a stat that should keep Democratic strategists up at night, said media scholar Reese Peck.
Indeed, respect is brilliant. But what we saw in the 2024 election is that shift of younger voters. And therein lies the opportunity for Democrats. I mean, we'll get to the cultural piece in a minute, but just in terms of the economic piece, there's a lot of economic anger out there in the United States. We're a very rich country with very poor outcomes. And people have focused on blue collar anger. But there's now also a lot of anger by younger people, even younger people with college degrees. They can't afford houses. They can't afford childcare. And so and the anti-oligarchy tour really showed this. The language of there's, you know, three-fourths of Americans have a skeptical attitude towards big business. We should be using this anti-elitist rhetoric, and it has the potential to forge a coalition between these middle status voters, so-called blue collar or working class voters, and the young people who shifted away from the Democratic Party in 2024 because we weren't speaking to their central concerns either.
Today, we are speaking with Joan Williams about her new book, Outclassed: How the Left Lost the Working Class and How to Win Them Back. This is a very important book. Joan Williams is professor of law and Hastings Foundation Chair Emerita at the University of California College of the Law, San Francisco. She's an award-winning scholar of social inequality. If you have any questions or comments, I'm sure we're already getting emails. I knew this would be a show that a lot of you would like to sound off on. What are your thoughts on this? How the left lost the working class and how to win them back? Give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Joan, when I was reading your book, I thought about a town hall that Senator Bernie Sanders had in McDowell County, West Virginia, in 2016. This is a county that went 75% to Donald Trump. Every person in that room was, well, did vote for Donald Trump. And so this is fascinating. I just want to play this clip and then I'd love to get your thoughts. So here is Bernie Sanders speaking in McDowell County, West Virginia. All of these people voted for Trump. This was in 2016.
And people will say, well, this is pie in the sky. He's being utopian. He's not being realistic. But what I want, the point that I want to make is, you know, I've been in Washington a while, and I see hundreds of billions of dollars going in tax breaks to people who don't need it. I see an enormous amount of waste and inefficiency. So what I'm going to tell you is not utopian. It's not crazy. It is real. For a start, health care must be a right of all people, workers and retirees. Number two, $1 trillion investment in infrastructure will improve the quality of life of McDowell County and Vermont and create 15 million jobs. Let's do it.
Yeah, that's good.
And again, when I talk about infrastructure for rural America, that includes good quality broadband.
Yes.
So that industry can come to your community. Yeah. And when we talk about the future, education is obviously the key. The world is changing. Again, this is not radicalism. I want every kid in Burlington, Vermont, and in McDowell County, West Virginia, to know that if he or she studies hard and does well in school, that those kids will be able to go to a public college or university tuition free.
So, Joan, there's Senator Bernie Sanders speaking to Trump voters in McDowell County, West Virginia, clapping at all of these policies. What are your thoughts?
It's painful to hear because a lot of polling also shows that policies traditionally embraced by Democrats are quite popular, and yet we're losing or barely scraping by. So there is clearly a disconnect. Now, one thing is that if you look at how people describe themselves, many, many more college graduates, a higher proportion of college graduates describes themselves as liberal than non-college graduates. So they don't consistently hold all of the and endorse all of these policies. But that doesn't mean they're centrist. That just means they have a mix of liberal and conservative policy preferences. We need to figure out what those liberal policy preferences are and connect with them. But the other thing this shows me, which is equally important, we as Democrats often, you know, have these overstuffed policy manifestos of like, I have a policy for that. We have a policy. You campaign in poetry. You don't campaign in policies. And listen to Bernie's style. It's a very plain spoken style. It's a very authentic style. He's not talking about a 17-point policy program. He's saying to people, I understand you feel like you've been screwed. I understand that your kids study hard and you work hard and you ain't going no place fast. And this is a ripoff. It's a ripoff economy. And I'm going to make sure that I change that. That is the message. Mm. And he's enacting, frankly, a style, what's called a working class taste culture, where, in my crowd, we tend to value people who are articulate and sophisticated and have all the facts. But in working class contexts, what's much more highly valued is sincerity, authenticity, a man who's not afraid to be masculine in a traditional way, which for, Bernie is. He's pretty traditional in that way. And Bernie has a little taste, which Trump has a lot of what's called bold but bad masculinity. You notice how Bernie is deftly signaling there that he isn't afraid to stand up to the powers that be, and he knows you aren't either. There's the bold but bad. John right. Fetterman, who of course is sadly facing now serious health challenges, has the style of masculinity that's very similar to Trump, this bold but bad.
Naomi Klein gave an interview last year, and she said that Steve Bannon did not want Bernie to run against Trump, because their policies on economics would be so clearly different. Whereas with some corporate Democrats, they don't talk like Bernie. I mean, Joan, you and I can have an entire conversation just about Bernie versus other Democrats. That conversation's been had, especially in 2016, 2020, with what happened with Bernie and then with Biden. But what are your thoughts about the Democratic Party? A lot of Democrats who've been in office for decades, some of the top leaders of the party, do not agree with what we just heard Bernie talk about in McDowell County, West Virginia, that got widespread applause from Donald Trump voters.
You know, I'll just say it again, Republican donors are smart enough, so they will, Rupert Murdoch will gladly finance Tucker Carlson railing against elites. Democratic donors have often stepped in to say, no, we're not going to do that. Fire Lena Khan. Don't use that language. And all I can say is, continue to do that if you want to continue to lose. What Bernie did is he connected both in terms of the focus on economics and the desire for people for a stable middle-class life and the ability to get of their kids to get jobs close to home. And he adopted a certain blue-collar style culture. He's not the only one that does it, and you don't have to mix it with the masculinity piece. Think of Gretchen Whitmer. One of her famous phrases was, if I elect me governor, I'm going to fix the damn roads. Mm-hmm. It's talking to people about their daily life, government making the life better for them in their daily life. And it's very straightforward. Or Marie Glusenkamp-Paris, who this is how she talks about climate change. She doesn't call people climate deniers. She says, my husband and I own an auto body shop, and we can't work in there if it's 116 degrees outside. So you need to be able to talk to people and not unwittingly use a style culture that they are going to read as not aimed at me. I'm not the key audience. And very often Democratic candidates feel they are unconsciously enacting a style culture that is very appealing to college graduates, but quite off-putting to non-college graduates. And so this culture piece is very important. Now, we know that the far right has cultural differences between the middle and college-educated elites. They've weaponized that beautifully into culture wars. And very often people on the left say, oh, we should just talk about economics and avoid cultural issues. That assumes that in order to get culture working for you, the only way to do that is the way the far right did, which is to look at the elements of working class culture that they can tap for their own political purposes, like, you know, war on trans, abortion, you name it, the culture wars issues. Democrats are not going to tap into working class culture in those ways. Life's too short. We wouldn't be Democrats if we did that. But there are other ways to tap into working class culture to achieve things that we really cherish. I mean, think of climate change, going back to climate change. You know, Biden did some of this. What climate change is about is creating the next generation of blue collar jobs. Climate change means that we'll address the tragedy of the farmer who can no longer farm in the way that his grandfather did because of this extreme weather. Climate change, well, what's happening is that middle-class people are losing their homes because of flooding. And guess who's going to be left holding the bag? It's the homeowners, because the insurance company, big business, is making sure they don't get left holding the bag. And actually, that's one of the things I said earlier on conservative radio. And, you know, there was only, yeah, absolutely. You can talk about climate change in a way that connects with that ocean of red in the middle of the country, or you can talk about climate change in a way that's going to only help the other side. Unfortunately, we very often do the second, not the first.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Joan Williams about her new book, Outclassed: How the Left Lost the Working Class and How to Win Them Back. Here's another fact from her book. The share of Americans who earn more than their parents has plummeted by 40%, with the largest declines for families in the middle class and the industrial Midwest. Joan Williams is professor of law and Hastings Foundation Chair Emerita at the University of California College of the Law, San Francisco. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with Greg Eskridge, founding member of the Uncuffed radio show. On July 23rd, 2024, Greg was released from San Quentin prison after serving 30 years and 25 days. And then he began working full-time as Uncuffed's first leadership fellow. So we'll talk with Greg tomorrow about his incredible work on the inside and the outside. Today, we are speaking with Joan Williams about her new book, Outclassed: How the Left Lost the Working Class and How to Win Them Back. Joan Williams is professor of law and Hastings Foundation Chair Emerita at the University of California College of the Law, San Francisco. If you're in the Bay Area, Joan Williams will be speaking Tuesday, May 27th at 5:30 p.m. at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, and Wednesday, May 28th at 7 p.m. at Mrs. Dalloway's bookstore in Berkeley. We have so many emails and a number of phone calls, so let's hear from people who've been waiting patiently. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello, thank you. I can't disagree with a word your guest has said, but there are a couple of problems that I'd like to hear her address them. One is the Democratic Party and the Democratic leadership are not talking the way she's talking. Okay, you still got Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries doing the same thing they were doing, 10 years ago. And then you've got big money. I mean, I don't know how you get beyond that in terms of these elections. You know, it'd be interesting to see, and this is why, unfortunately, we don't have a third party in this country. I don't know how you turn around the Democratic Party to advocate the kinds of things that she's advocating. Bernie Sanders has made it clear this is what people are interested in, but the Democratic Party just, you know, submarined him. They defeated him in his efforts to try and get into the presidency. I think he would have beaten Trump, but, you know, that's where we're stuck.
Well, thanks, Greg. What are your thoughts, Joan?
Well, you know, the Republican Party benefits from big money, and they tolerate anti-elitist rhetoric. They just ran a Democratic, they just ran a candidate who, although he lied, said he was going to help working people and bring down inflation. I actually, Greg, am very optimistic right now. Counterintuitively, I think that Democrats have a once-in-a-generation opportunity. First of all, tariffs, number one, Trump is giving sweetheart deals to big business and screwing small business. One of the things that Democrats have never fully understood is that small business plays an important political role in this country because it plays an important role in the aspirations and imagination of people in these routine, like blue collar, pink collar jobs, because they think their aspiration, their realistic aspiration, is to own a small business. You know, they aren't going to wait for a socialist revolution. For some reason, they don't think that's coming real soon. But owning a small business is a way out of being an order taker your whole life. Tariffs are screwing people in small businesses. And DOGE, which is just so horrifying, but it is teaching the American public something that the left hasn't done, shame on us, for decades, which is that government programs underlie stability for middle-class families. These folks promised they wouldn't cut Social Security. They promised they wouldn't cut Medicare. That's one of the reasons that Trump won, and that's one of the reasons he was so different from the other Republicans. Guess what they're doing? They're cutting funding at Social Security and at Medicare offices. Medicaid, you know, cutting Medicaid will mean that even more rural hospitals close down. These tariffs are hurting farmers. Who are they going to sell their soybeans to now? And the DOGE is hurting farmers. I mean, USAID, some of what they did was bought products from American farmers and sent them to areas of great hunger in the world. This is what Democrats should be all over. I really believe that big money is not an object so long as the big money on the left gets as smart as the big money on the right, and that we really could turn this around in short order if people would just understand that liberals are actually more likely than conservatives to talk in a way that is convincing to them, but not in a way that is convincing to their audience of non-liberals. We have to develop a class lens, a double consciousness to see things not only from our own point of view. Take the test which I just launched. It's called the New Class Bubble Quiz. And see if your own point of view is an elite point of view. For many people, you'll see it is. And we need to talk in a way that appeals to people in these routine jobs who do not have college degrees, who are just as smart as we are, but they're culturally very, very different.
What about Greg's question about the Bernie wing of the party and the corporate wing of the party? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the question is for the corporate wing of the Democratic Party, and for that matter, at this point, the corporate wing of the Republican Party, is whether this is a good business climate for them. It's not. It's a terrible business climate. You can't make a decision. There's so much instability. You can't make a decision from one day to the next. And the other, I keep saying, four Democratic donors need to wise up in the way that Republican donors did long ago. There's a lot of economic anger in the country. If the left doesn't channel it, we know who will. And it's the short road to fascism. That's what we're on now.
Well, thank you for the call, Greg. Let's go next to Crystal in San Rafael. Hi, Crystal. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I was calling because I went to UC Berkeley in the 70s, and my tuition was $300 a quarter. My husband-to-be was on Wall Street during the 70s, and his tax bracket was 90%. You know, both of those things have changed radically. It's really expensive for people to get an education now, and the 90% tax bracket is not helping to fund education for people. You know, I think you need an educated middle class to have a strong democracy, partly because, you know, understanding the complexities of our modern society takes some education. You know, when I got to Berkeley, it was like I was shocked. They expected me to know how to think. And I had gotten through high school with straight A's without ever learning how to think. I think our education system has really degraded, and that's a big part of the problem. People don't get educated to get better jobs, and people don't get educated to really think critically anymore.
Thank you so much for calling in, Crystal. It's incredible when you think about how much has changed with the cost of college. Joan, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, Crystal, you make two such good points. Public universities used to be very, very cheap. For that matter, my husband graduated from Yale College without a penny of debt, coming from a family where his father was the sole breadwinner and never earned more than $12,000 a year. The College for All ideal, it never worked. Two-thirds of Americans lack college degrees as we speak. And it certainly is not going to work now with these. I speak as, you know, someone who's benefited from this system my whole life. I've been a professor since I was 28 years old. But people can't afford it. But the other problem with, and the tax bracket is too, is just like gone with the wind. But, you know, a wedge issue among Republicans, which Democrats have really never yet learned how to take advantage of, is that these middle class, these blue collar Republicans believe that the rich don't pay enough taxes. Now, the rich, wealthy Republicans don't, but that the Democrats should be able to use that as a wedge issue. But the deeper point, I think, is that we need to think about this College for All ideal for a couple of reasons. Number one, we never delivered. Number two, we're certainly not going to now, given the cost of college. And number three, not everybody wants to go to college. A lot of people who are deeply rooted in blue-collar values and blue-collar families, they don't want to go to college. They want to do things with their hands. They want to build stuff. And they think of college grads as people who talk for a living. God knows that's true of me. And there's been a marked diminishment of respect for blue-collar jobs. And I say, as a feminist, there was never a lot of respect for people in pink collar jobs. And that kind of disrespect is rocket fuel for the right. We have to understand that. I mean, if you go into a post office, you see WPA murals, largely painted by communists, by the way, including in San Francisco. But they really held up the blue-collar man as a paragon of masculinity. There was sexism, totally, get that. But that kind of respect for blue collar lives is, you know, frankly, one of the things that Fox News channels very effectively. Now, I know it's hypocritical. You don't have to tell me it's hypocritical. Trump is not delivering for these people, but he is mouthing respect for blue collar guys. By the way, this developer who stiffed and didn't pay his plumbers, whatever, his the other blue collar guys who worked for him. So it's completely hypocritical. But too often Democrats are lacking that, and they're calling rural people takers and deplorables and bitter people clinging to guns and religion. There's unfortunately very much, I hate to say it, on the left, kind of a culture of casual class insults that sets up the right beautifully. Another thing that's a more subtle point is the current, the current entrenchment now on the left, for entirely understandable reasons, that we got to focus on defense of democracy. We've got to focus on defense of democracy. But you know what? One of the best ways to defend democracy is to stop talking about defense of democracy. As I say, people who have been screwed by the system for the last 40 years, they are not interested in defending the system. If you really want to defend democracy, learn how to connect with working class values, with working class priorities, and with the working class's need for respect. That's the path to defending democracy.
Today we are speaking with Joan Williams about her new book, Outclassed: How the Left Lost the Working Class and How to Win Them Back. Let's take a few callers. I'll read a few emails and then we'll ask Joan to respond. Let's go next to BJ in Oakland. Hi, BJ.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, thanks. I like Greg, agree with what Professor Williams is saying, but what she seems to be saying in general and what the Democrats are saying is we have to get our messaging better. And I think the fact is that many of the 77 million people who voted for Trump won't hear the message because they are getting their information from a vast, growing network of right-wing disinformation. And if the Democrats can't figure out some way to penetrate that, possibly by TV ads on shows that MAGA Republicans watch, not Fox News, then it's just going to get worse. I mean, there was an article in the New Republic a couple of months ago by a person whose first last name begins T-O-M, although I can't remember the rest of it. And he said he characterized the traditional news media as a volleyball. And in the last 10 or 15 years, the right-wing disinformation media is a basketball. And they're growing. So there's all you have to do is look at the election. 77 million people primarily concerned about prices and inflation, and voted for a guy who was proposing to increase both of them, and they never knew that because they listened to right-wing.
Well, thank you for the call, BJ. We've got a lot of similar emails, Joan, about how the media has changed so much even over the last 5 years. What are your thoughts on this? Because some people, you've got OAN News, which is, goes beyond what Fox says. And then so many shows that a lot of us may have never heard of that are very popular.
Well, I mean, I appreciate BJ's comments. There's really a technical fix and a deeper fix. The technical fix is the right learned how to communicate with people. The left needs to learn how to communicate with people too. And it's not the New York Times, much as I love the New York Times. I think the New York Times is important. That's not how to communicate to non-college voters. So there are smart people out there who understand how to use social media, because this is not about television, how to use social media to connect with people. That's the first step. But there's also a deeper problem here, which is this is not just a messaging problem. And I think about gay marriage and the gay marriage success really as the model. You know, the gay marriage advocates, the gay liberation movement, they changed messaging. But the only reason they can change messaging is that they changed priorities. The gay liberation movement was not interested in marriage. A lot of them thought, ugh, we like marriage like a hole in the head. We're talking about respect for a wide range of sexualities and complete reorganization of intimacy. They were not interested in marriage. But I interviewed a colleague of mine at UC Law who led the ACLU's gay marriage initiative. And he said, you know, he actually told me this amazing story of after they got domestic partnership in California, what the Alameda County clerk did, and she set up tables with heart balloons and a procession down a grand staircase. And he said, I looked at these folks and they weren't doctors and lawyers, they were ordinary people. And I suddenly realized this was the prom, the marriage ceremony. This was the ability to say, Mom, I got married. In other words, a lot of people he recognized, particularly non-college people, they didn't want to smash the hegemony. They just wanted to join it. Now, that's not true of all gay people. I'm not saying it should be true of gay people. I'm saying it is true of many working class gay people. And so the movement's elite gatekeepers realized that as Matt told me, this is what our people wanted. They changed priorities. Now, they didn't give up. They didn't shut up about gay rights. No, but they chose a way to into gay rights that could connect with the moral intuitions of ordinary people. And that is the first thing that you have to do in order to successfully change messaging. The message they changed was they shifted to commitment, but they couldn't have done that unless they changed priorities in the first place.
And Joan, we're unfortunately out of time, but we'd love to have you back because we have so many emails that we didn't have time to get to. Obviously, so many people want to talk about these issues. Joan Williams is the author of Outclassed. She'll be speaking Tuesday, May 27th at 5:30 at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, Wednesday, May 28th at 7 p.m. at Mrs. Dalloway's bookstore in Berkeley. Thank you so much, Joan. We'd love to have you back. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar.
Thank you, Rose. I'd love to come back. I really enjoyed it.